Welcome back. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What do you remember about the 1960s? If you're too young to have lived through it, what are the common images you have of that era? What about the 70s, the so-called Me Generation? Do you remember the Zodiac and zebra murders and the many bombs that went off during that turbulent time? Well, David Talbot takes us through those staggering years in his new book, Season of the Witch. It chronicles the hope of the hippies and new music during the Summer of Love, and then reminds us of the tragedies that followed. Talbot writes, by the early 1970s, the revolution was over in America, and San Francisco, its fallen capital, staggered on the edge of chaos. The sacraments of blood and guns replaced peace and love. Talbot's book takes us inside of that chaos and examines the gripping history of Northern California and the creation of San Francisco values out of the ashes of destruction. So welcome, David.
Great to be here, Holly.
It's wonderful to have you. David Talbot is the founder of Salon and the author of this new book, Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. I'll let you know where he's going to be reading in just a little while. But David, I was wondering what prompted you to write this book, since it seems like there's already so much written about this period. And when I initially started the book, I was thinking that, and then I was shocked to find out how much I had no idea about.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of mythology, particularly about the 60s, of course, and the Summer of Love and all that. But it's a fairly superficial, I think, reading of that history. And what I wanted to do was begin there, because that is the great moment of modern San Francisco, of course, the Summer of Love, 1967, when people from all around the world literally were pouring young people into the city, following this dream of what life could be like in an idyllic
And the idea you could reinvent yourself here, right?
Absolutely. And run away from all the kind of tribulations that you were growing up with as a young person in those days. But in any case, so we kind of know that history a little bit, but not even as deeply as we should, because what we need to know, for one thing, was how tough those young people were and how tough the Haight-Ashbury and that community had to be to survive and come through a lot of very trying events. And then, of course, as you said, the 70s, we know maybe some of the highlights, Patty Hearst and her kidnapping by the SLA, Zodiac murders and so on, the assassinations of Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone. But there's a much deeper and darker story there as well.
And you really tie it all together and try to make sense of how all of this happened and how it led us to be where we are now.
Exactly.
But before we get to Enchantment and Terror, can you just talk, you lay a bit of the groundwork in the book about kind of San Francisco in the 30s as a labor town, a very Irish Catholic city. Can you talk about that conservative San Francisco that really is the foundation for everything that would come again?
Absolutely. Well, so again, I didn't want to just start with the hippie era, because the hippies were immediately confronted by this very traditional city in some ways, this old Irish Catholic, Italian Catholic, old boys network that ran City Hall, that ran the police department. I mean, San Francisco has a lot of that. You can feel that. You know, people ask you what school you went to. They're not talking about what university. They're talking about what parochial school you went to here in San Francisco. And look, you know, a lot of that world was quite liberal. It was a pro-union, tough town. Jack Shelley was mayor at the time, Irish Catholic guy close to JFK. They'd been young congressmen in Washington together. This was not a reactionary culture. But in social terms, they were not prepared for these young people hitting the streets. And the city literally pulls up the drawbridges. But this old San Francisco, this great sort of Irish Catholic tough town, goes back to the 1920s, the 1930s. That's why I want to begin the book there with my prologue, telling the wonderful story of Vincent Hallinan, the great crusading lawyer, and his glamorous young wife, Vivian. And to me, if you know your Dashiell Hammett and the Thin Man series and the movies, they were a San Francisco's true life, Nick and Nora, Vincent and Vivian. They hung out with mobsters and millionaires. They were tough. They were glamorous. They were smart. They were always getting in and out of trouble. And under Vivian's kind of tutelage, Vincent becomes more and more politically aware over the years, until in the Cold War period, he's up against not only City Hall and the Catholic Church, but the federal government.
And McCarthyism.
During the McCarthy period, absolutely. And the federal government goes after him because he's defending Harry Bridges, the great longshoreman leader who the federal government and the FBI were constantly harassing and accusing him of being a member of the Communist Party and trying to deport. Vincent was one of the great criminal defense attorneys in town. He took the case bravely because he knew he was going to come under enormous pressure. He did. They trumped up tax evasion charges against him, the federal government. They threw him in McNeil Island Penitentiary off Washington twice. He was away from his family. He had, by then, a brood of young, brawling young boys who were growing up without their father.
One of whom would go on to become a supervisor and DA here, Terrence Hallinan.
Yes, or Kay. Because all the kids had boxer monikers, because they had to be tough, because they were being jumped too, because their old man was, you know, being accused of a communist in the press, and they were being beaten up. So Vincent, when he came home from prison, said, you know, screw this, I'm going to hire a great boxer to train my kids how to defend themselves. And they were just as tough as their old man. So this is the great sort of San Francisco that history that I wanted to share with people before we got into the sort of hippie era. Because San Francisco was, you know, as I say, you know, was not, those values were not born with flowers in their hair, the San Francisco values. They were born howling in blood and strife.
All right, so the hippies and the flower children do begin arriving in San Francisco. Why do you think that San Francisco was the epicenter of the so-called 60s?
Well, look, that sort of image of the open town goes back to our very roots, back to the gold rush days in the 1840s. It was a wide open town. It attracted outcasts and swashbucklers and fortune seekers from all around the world looking to make it rich quick, and gold and gold mines and silver mines. And, you know, it was the kind of town where when the ladies of the night, the madams, would come into the opera house, the gentlemen would stand up and tip their hats to them because they were deeply respected as kind of the establishment in San Francisco. During the 1920s, the Board of Supervisors passed a law that prevented the police department from enforcing the prohibition laws. So San Francisco always had this feeling that, as you know, the saying used to go, you can do anything you want in this town, just don't scare the horses. And that, of course, leads up to then the 50s with the Beats coming here. It was cheap. It was an easy town. It was beautiful. So, you know, Lawrence Ferlinghetti arrives fresh out of the Merchant Marine and opens City Lights Bookstore. Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg quickly follow. So the Beats then, of course, are the link to the hippie era as well. And so San Francisco, certainly by the 50s and 60s, was well on its way to being the bohemian capital of the country.
All right, and you paint this very vivid picture of the hate in the 60s. Can you kind of give us a sense, describe that picture, the human being, Joplin, walking around the hate, Huckleberry House? What was it like?
Well, it was like a small town. That's how people described it who lived in that era, particularly before it all started to happen, when it was on the verge, on the edge, in 1965, 66, before the invasion of the Summer of Love. And, you know, you did have this young band, the Grateful Dead, living across the street from you. I tell the story of Marilyn Kriegel, who was a young school teacher in town. And she just said they were the best neighbors in the world. At one point, she got seriously ill with hepatitis. She literally couldn't get herself out of bed. The band, Pigpen, those of you who know, your deadheads out there know who I'm talking about, Pigpen, Jerry, Bob Weir, they tacked a sign-up sheet on her front door for all the chores that she needed. You know, the food brought into her, cooked for her. Literally, they were taking her up out of the bed, helping her get to the bathroom. And so she just said that was the kind of spirit of the place. And the Dead really represented that with their free music in the park and the way they were so neighborly.
And what about, like, the Diggers? Explain to us what the Diggers were.
A Diggers, another great institution then. It was a split-off from the San Francisco Meme Troupe. These were young actors, radicals, anarchists. You know, a lot of what they were talking about would echo today with the Occupy movement. They were talking about having a free city. They wanted to liberate San Francisco. Free music, free clothes store in the hate. When if you went in there and tried to shoplift, they would say, hey, you can't do that. Everything's free. They had food giveaways in the park and down the panhandle. So this was a group that was actually more provocateurs than, you know, Good Samaritans in some ways. They wanted to just get people thinking about what kind of life do you really want? Do you want to chop your life up into these 9-to-5 increments where you don't, you know, really enjoy the sensuality and the beauty of daily life? So they were wonderful street provocateurs. There was, speaking of free, the whole notion of free, which was percolating so much in those days, the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic is another wonderful institution that comes out of San Francisco in those years.
And why was it necessary to set up the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic?
Well, because you had these kids from all over the country, thousands and thousands of them showing up, sleeping in the park, on the streets. They thought San Francisco in the summer was going to be sunny and beautiful.
Whoops.
Whoops, exactly. It's cold, it's foggy, they're sick. Those hospitals, even St. Mary's and the Haight, refused to deal with them when they had drug problems. The San Francisco medical establishment just did not want them here, along with the political establishment. And so Dr. David Smith, a young intern at UCSF, scrapes together $500. He opens up a former dentist dental clinic on Clayton Street in the Haight. And it's this, Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. The first day, there's 250 kids lined up for treatment. They're suffering from everything you can imagine, malnutrition, illegal abortions, hepatitis. And they run out of bandages. They run out of medicine. There's 350 the next day. People who worked with him, young volunteers who had worked as medics in Vietnam, were comparing it to a battlefield-like situation. But the
because of all the drugs?
Well, the drugs and just the kind of medical problems that they were facing and the lack of resources they had. The city wasn't helping in any way. Finally, Bill Graham, the great rock impresario who's running the Fillmore Auditorium, says, look, these are basically my customers, and they're sick, and they need help. And he comes to Dr. Smith and says, what do you need? And he begins to hold benefit concerts for them. And Dr. Smith says, literally, this clinic was built on rock and roll, just like the city.
So tell us about Bill Graham, obviously a very big figure in this period.
Fascinating guy. Of course, literally walked away from the concentration camps as a young boy in Europe with his sister. Lost two family members, two or three, to the Holocaust in Europe. The group of young children who flee the orphanage in France, not all of them make it. Many die along the way, but Bill ends up in New York during the war and grows up, is adopted by a Jewish family in New York. Tough guy, went to war in Korea, was awarded medals and fought and served there. Comes back and in some ways is a complete anomaly here in San Francisco. He's a tough New York street guy who likes Latin music more than rock and roll, really. But he's completely seduced by San Francisco because he's dying to break into show business. He can't do it in L.A. or New York. It's too tough for a guy like him with no connections. But in San Francisco, you could recreate yourself. You could...
Again, this theme.
Absolutely. So people like, Robert Crumb, R. Crumb, coming here, who worked in a greeting card company in Cleveland and comes to the streets of San Francisco and becomes the R. Crumb, the great comic, underground comic artist we know today. And that was the kind of town it was. It beckoned to people who couldn't break in anywhere else because they were too weird, they were too fringy, and they were dreaming too big. But San Francisco embraced them.
So that's really enchantment. That's the first part of your book. And then you write, as the decade expired, the drugs became harder, the sexual freedom more rapacious, the demands on the human psyche more severe, and that things start to break down. I think it's in 1969 that the Manson murders happen. And you also write about the Altamont concert and the Hells Angels. I've never understood the draw of the Hells Angels, so I wonder if you could just tell us what happened there and why were the Angels such a powerful force?
Well, that's a great story. The Hells Angels, and they keep popping up in my book throughout the book, they really represent sort of the yin and yang of San Francisco, both the dark and the light. In many ways, they were the security that the people in the Haight needed. because the police had basically said, you're on your own. You know, if you all kill each other, it's fine with us. So the police were not, couldn't be depended on. For instance, when
they closed down the station in the Haight, did you say?
That's right. At one point they did. Dr. Smith at one point is threatened by meth dealers, speed dealers, who want to basically...
This is at the free clinic.
That's right. Who want to take over the free clinic. He goes in desperation to police for protection. They're threatened to kill him and his right-hand person. The cops said, sorry, you know, they're going to have to kill you before we do anything. So Dr. Smith goes to Sonny Barger, the head of the Angels, and says, will you help take care of this? He did. Those meth dealers never bothered Dr. Smith again. So in some ways, they are this positive force because the community does need some self-policing. The Angels were there. It was like I say in the book, it was like taking a mountain lion into a party on a leash. It could all be cool, or it could all go to hell. And
it doesn't necessarily seem like the greatest idea.
Yes, in many cases it's not.
All right, so we get to Altamont.
Well, Altamont. So Altamont after Woodstock was going to be the next great free concert, this great celebration of not only San Francisco values, but the values of the 60s themselves, peace and love. The Rolling Stones had been getting a lot of heat from the community in those days because that's what we did to bands when we thought they were selling out and were making too much money. And so to sort of pay back, to the community, they were going to hold a free concert at the end of their tour that year in 1969. Originally, it was supposed to be in Golden Gate Park, which had always been a great venue for these free concerts, the Jefferson Airplane, the Grateful Dead. But when the city heard about it, they said, no way, the Rolling Stones is going to be, a huge, kind of infringement on the park. We have to move this out elsewhere. So they end up in a very dusty, remote place out in Altamont of a speedway. And thousands of these young people are crammed together. It turns slowly throughout the day more and more hellish, more and more hard drugs being circulated, cheap red wine, the Hells Angels who are providing security around this very low-slung stage are getting more and more hostile or beating up people. And by the time the Rolling Stones finally take the stage, the Hells Angels were furious at the band for waiting so long. They were furious at the crowd. They were in no mood to put up with anything. And then, of course, this is when it all erupts, when a young African-American teenager from Berkeley, in desperation, according to eyewitnesses, because he'd been being roughed up all day long, draws a gun, and the Hells Angels, like a swarm, jump him, beat him to death, knife him to death, and all while Mick Jagger is playing on stage with the Stones and looking feebly out at the crowd and trying to restore calm. Keith Richards, the lead guitarist, at one point turns to Sonny Barger and says, I'm not playing. We're not playing unless you get your act together and quit,
beating people up. Yeah.
And Barger sticks a gun in his ribs and says, you better keep playing or you're a dead man. So that's how the 60s are starting to come apart.
And then we'll get to this next phase of your book, which is terror. But I want to invite our listeners in. You're listening to Your Call. We're talking with David Talbot. He's the author of The Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. And you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you lived in San Francisco or Northern California in the 60s and 70s, how do you remember these times? We'd love to hear from you. And what do you consider to be San Francisco values? How do you think that they're viewed from the national perspective? How we look at San Francisco values may be very different than how they are portrayed elsewhere. And what do you think of David Talbot's premise that this book, that San Francisco is the city that changed itself and then changed the world? You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255, or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And David will be signing books today, right after the show, Wednesday, today at 12:30 at Alexander Books in San Francisco. He'll also be reading at Book Passage in San Francisco on Thursday, June 7th at 6 p.m. and at Copperfield Books in Petaluma on Friday, June 8th at 7 p.m. We'll put all of that information at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. And again, let me give you the number. If there's anything that you'd like to know about Jim Jones and the People's Temple and their ties to local politicians or the SLA, this book is packed with information about this time. time. Any questions you have, call us at 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. And if you were somebody who bore witness to this time, we really want to hear from you. 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. All right, so as I said, the book is split into three parts. Enchantment, which we've talked about, and then this part, Terror, which I guess Altamont kind of leads into. And this was the part of the book that I just... I was a little kid at this time, but I don't remember hearing most of this history. So maybe you could start by talking about the Zebra murders, which I had never heard of before.
Well, a lot of what strikes San Francisco, these traumas in the 70s, are perversions of the 60s dream. So you can see how they sort of come out in a warped way from what began as a very positive and very liberating spirit. So with Zebra, these were young men who belonged to the Nation of Islam. And, of course, they were very concerned about African-American rights and were very sensitive to all the injustices that had been perpetrated against African-Americans throughout the country, and even here in San Francisco, by the way, which was a pretty intolerant town until, you know, the civil rights struggles took hold here. There had to be sit-ins at the car showrooms on Van Ness, at diners, and this is the early 1960s, and we're not talking about the Deep South.
Right, and the Republican National Convention was here in 64, and I know Belva Davis said she had to run out of there in terror.
That's right. That's right. So San Francisco was a civil rights battleground, too, and these young men had grown up in this kind of very acrimonious, you know, era and had become very bitter. And they joined the Nation of Islam. They became a very violent sect within it. And a group of these young men began prowling the streets of San Francisco in 1974, and looking for white victims, random white victims of all ages. At one point, they target a group of kids who are able to flee. But they pick up a young couple. They pick up older or drive by and shoot older people at random. Some are brutally murdered, are kidnapped and brutally murdered. And slowly, as the word of these murders and as the realization starts to sink into the city, this is it's a black on white crime. The city that had prided itself on being a beacon of sort of racial tolerance and enlightenment begins to panic. Are we on the are we on the verge of a race war? Herb Kane, the great columnist for the Chronicle, starting to get letters and calls from readers saying, you know, if any more white people die, two of them are going to die for every white person. There is, in fact, a drive-by shooting where a young African-American serviceman who's stationed at the Presidio is shot and killed by a truck with two young white men in it. So San Francisco was, I think, on the brink of something truly horrible until the case was finally cracked by the police.
And there were 23 people, murders, right?
23 that we know about, possibly more, were killed during this Zebra spree. And at one point, Mayor Alioto, in desperation, institutes the first racial profiling campaign in a major American city. Young African Americans are randomly being stopped by police and picked up. There's so much tension, even within the San Francisco Police Department, that at one point there's a near gun battle between African-American officers and white officers.
Within the San Francisco.
Wow. Exactly. So, you know, I, at the time, was a young reporter, and I was writing about this for Rolling Stone magazine. It was such a grim story that Rolling Stone couldn't print it. I think it was so racially charged, so politically charged, that the media didn't want to touch it. And I think for some reason, this is why it's kind of disappeared from our history. But it's an important chapter for us to deal with, because everything that San Francisco basically got through in those years made us a stronger city.
Well, we have just a couple seconds before we go to our break. Can you quickly tell us how they diffused something that could have become a race war?
Well, cracking the case, that was the main thing. So a shout out to the Greek-American cops, Fotinos and Carreras, and Jack Cleary, Irish cop, and African-American cops, who Earl Sanders and his partner, who cracked it.
And that's David Talbot, author of Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. We're talking about what we're calling San Francisco values, but really sort of Northern California values, and the history of the area in the 60s and the 70s. We have a full bank of callers, but when a line opens, you can join us at 866-798-TALK or send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.com. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco. And if you're on Facebook, becoming a fan of KALW is an easy way to spread the word about the programming that you value on local public radio. It's easy. Just click the Facebook link on the front page of KALW.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the two statewide measures to increase the tax on cigarettes and change term limits. The primary is next week. Friday, of course, is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. And today we're exploring the tumultuous history of Northern California in the 60s and 70s and asking how that time came to shape this place we all call home and the values of tolerance and caring for each other. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Did I get that number right? 8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And David Talbot's book is Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. It is a page-turner. He'll be doing a book signing today, right after the show, at 12:30 at Alexander Books in San Francisco. He'll also be reading at Book Passage in San Francisco on Thursday, June 7th at 6 p.m. and at Copperfield Books in Petaluma on Friday, June 8th and at 7 p.m. And we'll put all of that information at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Rick in Marin. Welcome to Your Call, Rick. Hello, Rick. You're on the line. Okay, so I'm going to go to Diane in Berkeley. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to Your Call.
Thanks. I was there. I'm one of those people. And I was like in my late teens and early 20s and came to the Bay Area just, you know, around the late 60s, beginning 1970. Lived in Berkeley for many years and spent a lot of time in San Francisco and had lovers who lived in communes. And I didn't quite live in a commune, but I was some kind of a hippie for sure. And, you know, I was aware of all the political turmoil and the anti-war movement. And I was right in Berkeley when the Patty Hearst business went down right there and all those things. And definitely attentive to all that. But, you know, I was one of those hippies who was on the peace, love, sex, drugs, rock and roll side of things. And what I remember most about that period, besides turmoil, what I really remember most, besides long hair and all that and fun, was the idealism. I mean, there was a beautiful thing underneath going on inside people in the 60s that maybe doesn't get talked about as much. And it was a real sincere desire to spread a positive message and improve the world and have more peace and have, not so different from some of the Occupy goals, less income inequality and you know, of course, we call people the establishment who had money and corporations and all that at the time. But we wanted to change the world, and we didn't change it quite like we thought, of course. We didn't remake the world into a utopia, but I think there are many, many changes that did come out of that idealism, and, you know, I won't list them now. They're too many, but and there's still people like me around who still have those ideals and values. I do volunteer work. I still do progressive political work. Many of us do. Many of us have re-met in Occupy recently. So there was that. There was that positive thread. Some good things came out of it despite the crumbling and the drugs and the violence that happened as well.
And Diane, what do you consider what we're saying San Francisco values, which, you know, encompasses, I think, Berkeley and Oakland and Santa Cruz, et cetera. Is it that idealism? What would you characterize as San Francisco values?
Well, I don't think you can give it one name because, you know, it's like an elephant with many sides. I mean, there were so many people in society. I mean, you had a lot of I guess the progressive side of things. You had an idealistic sense of wanting, like I said, peace and political on the progressive side in politics and all that. But I wouldn't dare to stamp San Francisco with any one value system. It's hard to label. You know, you had conservatives too. You had, you know, you had the Hells Angels. I mean, it was an incredible melting pot in a complex society at the time, still is. But it was very dynamic, very intense. By the way, the music was to die for. I mean, we haven't had pop music like that since.
That's for sure.
And David has a playlist in his book, which is Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. That's David Talbot, who is our guest here. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Thanks so much, Diane.
And I think she makes a good point to remind us of the beauty and the idealism of that period. And as my book bookends that in a way, beginning with the Enchantment and then the Deliverance. And I think those values did survive largely intact. You know, Paul Kantner from the great band Jefferson Airplane told me, you know, we were creating our own reality, the reality that we wanted to live in, where these values, and I define these values, by the way, San Francisco values, as a kind of live and let live tolerance, a shared sense of humanity, and an openness to change and innovation. I think that's sort of the bedrock values of San Francisco.
Why do you think those values are so vilified in the rest of the nation?
Well, I think they're threatening to people, you know, people in authority, certainly people who tend to organize their lives, let's just say it, around power and greed. That's not the values that they embrace. I think everything that we incubate here, all the new ideas, gay marriage, a livable minimum wage, universal health care, immigrant sanctuary, on and on.
Sustainable food systems,
green cities, exactly. That threatens people who have a vested interest in a different kind of society. And they've obviously been resisting the spread of these values very vigorously, from Fox News to the Republican Party. But slowly, these values are taking hold in other places. I mean, just as recently as President Obama's statement on gay marriage shows that San Francisco values are slowly winning.
Well, and there was a pushback in the 70s as well. I mean, one of the terror ends with your chapter about what happened in the struggle during the Moscone administration, the struggle for gay rights, and between Dan White, Harvey Milk, and Mayor Moscone.
That's right. So, you know, the civil war that we're seeing today, the culture war, there's nothing at the national level that was as bloody and violent as what went on in this city. So when Harvey Milk was elected as the great champion of gay liberation, and Mayor Moscone, who's bringing in minorities and women and gays into City Hall and opening the power structure in San Francisco, that provoked a reaction from the Old Boys Network. And Dan White was a representative of that, had grown up in a traditional Irish Catholic neighborhood and family, a choir boy, you know, had served with the police department and San Francisco Fire Department. And he was threatened by this new San Francisco, as many from that world were, and couldn't find a way to accommodate it. Interestingly, I mean, fascinating, the personal chemistry between Harvey Milk and him when they were elected at the same time at the Board of Supervisors. Harvey Milk, because that was Harvey's way, reached out to Dan White, and Dan White invited Harvey to the christening of his son. So in the beginning, they almost were trying to work out a friendship. But Dan ultimately couldn't do that. They became, you know, dire political enemies. And then this, of course, culminates in the terrible dual assassination by Dan White of both Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk. But that, to me, was sort of the final eruption. And that cleared the way for this new San Francisco under the leadership, and very stable leadership, of Dianne Feinstein, who takes over as mayor. And, you know, she was mocked at the time.
Somebody who couldn't get elected on her own, right?
Couldn't get elected on her own.
She didn't embody these new San Francisco values.
Absolutely. Too centrist, too cautious, too middle of the road. Really didn't fit into this, you know, the new San Francisco. But she's thrust into that office through these terrible events. And, you know, she enshrines those values slowly. She brings in more minorities and gays. She continues that process that was continued, that was started by Mayor Alioto and Moscone. And she also, very importantly, confronts the AIDS epidemic with great compassion and a very effective leader when the city needed that kind of leadership most.
San Francisco was spending more in this city than they were than the country was nationally.
Absolutely.
On AIDS and prevention and research and care. You're listening to David Talbot. He's the author of Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. This is Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we have a lot of callers, so I want to try and get to some. Philip in Oakland, welcome to Your Call.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, interesting program. I grew up in Albany. I'm 63, so I lived through that whole era. I remember early on watching the news almost every night they had something about the hippies and what was going on and scandals and events and happenings and so on. But gradually, after about 67, really the war took over. The war issues really took over. The hate faded as something newsworthy, but I remember
the hate the neighborhood. You mean?
Well, I'm sorry. Hate, yeah, hate actually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I remember the air was full of the talk of revolution, and we always, when I was in high school, we'd say, "Hey, you know, you think the revolution's going to come soon?" And we were kind of naive, but there was this feeling in the air, as well as all the marijuana smoke in the air. I mean, marijuana was everywhere.
Some things never change.
Yeah, and my memory of the zebra killings. I have one specific memory. I hope it's correct, but my memory is that the big break in the case came when one of the people who was assaulted was shot through the neck. He grabbed the guy's gun and shot him. And this guy, the guy who had shot him, he shot him back, essentially. And the police caught him. And that was the big break in the case. That's my memory of it.
And David, what do you
actually
recall
no,
about
the,
that?
The yeah. major break in that case came when officers Fatinos and Carreras, these two Greek-American cops who were leading the case, had a police artist do a sketch. And the sketch was a very generic sketch. It could have been any one of young African-American males. But one of the people who was part of the Zebra Group thought he recognized himself when this sketch was published, and he thought the heat was on him. And he had been having severe doubts already about what he was doing and about the others that he was in league with. So he went to the police then at that point, thinking that they were onto him anyway, and he began to tell them the inside story. And that's what really led to the case being cracked.
Let's go to another caller. Thank you to Philip in Oakland. Jamie in Santa Cruz, welcome to your call.
Right. I just wanted to say that I'm a newcomer. I lived in the Santa Cruz area 20 years ago and then moved back here now. And I have a sense of San Francisco. I don't live there. It seems like this is sort of torn from the headlines. And the trouble with headlines is that they emphasize violence. The day-to-day life in San Francisco, as has been just recently noted in this discussion, is actually healthier than that and has been, I believe, for some time. It doesn't mean there isn't violence in cities, but this city is properly noted for being probably the most open-minded city in the world, if not in the United, at least in the United States. And I think we should remember that, even though the arc of the book takes you from it's a valid arc to from supposed loveliness to some fairly serious problems. But I think if we really look at what, for instance, San Francisco has meant for AIDS and for the openness of the society in general, yes, of course, people in the East who have never been there want to go la la la, and there's a lot of people in the great unwashed rightist people in the United States who just want to vilify everything that's liberal. Nevertheless, the city represents an extraordinary experiment in human openness.
Yeah,
and that's really what David Talbot writes about in the last chapter, Deliverance. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I was going to say, look, this is not a reactionary book. This is a celebration of San Francisco values. But it's my Valentine to San Francisco. But it's a bloody Valentine. And you have to be real, too. I'm a journalist and a historian, and I wanted to chronicle this, not just from headline to headline, but in a deeper way.
It does go very deep into each of these scenarios.
But at the end, I feel, and this is the whole last section of my book called Deliverance, the city does triumph. The city gets through these violent times. It's stabilized under the leadership of Mayor Feinstein. The city does come together to grapple with AIDS when the rest of the country, you know, President Reagan wouldn't even use the term AIDS, refused to utter the term publicly. You know, people, cities and states were dumping their AIDS patients in San Francisco, but Mayor Feinstein said, spend whatever we have to. Ward 5B, the AIDS ward at San Francisco General Hospital, becomes a model of compassion and treatment. And so my book, this is how it ends. And then, of course, let's talk about something that some people feel is kind of light or superficial, but the San Francisco 49ers. I think their great run for the Super Bowl in 1981-82, coming out of this terrible era of trauma, really did help uplift the city. And when this eccentric coach, more of a poet than a gladiator in many ways, Bill Walsh, takes over the team.
And you say his team was more sort of represented that San Francisco underdog.
Eccentricities, misfits, yeah. Outcasts. Bill Walsh hires the first openly gay trainer, Lindsay McLean. He hires Harry Edwards, the great black sociologist at Berkeley, who was a militant in the 60s and helped inspire the young athletes in Mexico City Olympics to raise their fists. You know, no NFL team would have hired people like this, because they were too radical for most people or out of, you know, the ordinary. And he cobbles together this team, rookies, kind of washed up has-beens. No one expected that team to go all the way that year and become Super Bowl champions, but they did. And when the team comes back from Michigan to celebrate their great victory in January 1982, they're in their motorcade. They're on the Embarcadero. They see only a few people on the streets. Mayor Feinstein, Bill Walsh, Eddie DeBartolo, the owner of the team, thinks, oh, my God, you know, San Francisco really doesn't care. And yet they turn onto Market Street, and there's this explosion of celebration and humanity, people of all types. The whole city's represented. They're gay and straight, young and old, blue collar, white collar. And Bill Walsh begins to cry. He was an emotional man because he sees what this, the team has done for the city. So my book ends on a very triumphant note. I love that San Francisco now has become, a beacon for the world in many ways, and an innovator for the world and the rest of the country. We get all kinds of heat from Fox News and the Republican presidential candidates. But as FDR said about his political enemies, I welcome their hatred.
Well, speaking of hatred, I want to go back to terror for just one moment, because I think that there's something in this book that I hadn't realized how deep Jim Jones and the People's Temple's political ties were here in San Francisco. He was able to essentially have everybody in his pocket, from the police force to the politicians to, I believe, even business owners, and was able to absolutely subvert this city through blackmail or bribery. How was he able to do that so successfully without anybody really being able to investigate him? Even those who tried were thwarted by their bosses.
Well, Jim Jones was a genius at manipulation. He was a great charlatan. He not only hijacked the great liberationist rhetoric of the 60s, you know, Martin Luther King type rhetoric, but he was able to find out what a politician's weakness was and play them in a brilliant way. You know, if San Francisco had been a Republican city in those years, he would have done it with Republicans.
Well, and he did up north, right?
In fact, he did up north when he lived up north in Ukiah. That was a Republican town, and he insinuated himself into that Republican political machinery. He was writing flattering letters to Ronald Reagan, to Henry Kissinger. So he didn't care about, you know, politics. He cared about power, his own power. And so he comes into San Francisco. He realizes it's a liberal city. Mayor Moscone in office, Harvey Milk being elected to the board. And he quickly begins to cuddle up to them and offer him his organization services, which means vote getting and vote stealing. He got his troops on the streets during the campaigns. He delivered the vote. Many people feel that he was going from precinct to precinct and having his followers vote multiple times. Mayor Moscone won his first election in 1975 by a very narrow margin, only about 4,000 votes. And his opponents in that race, John Barber Gelada and others, felt that it had been stolen by People's Temple. So Moscone owed Jim Jones, and he used that very effectively.
And let's go to more calls. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with David Talbot. He's the founder of Salon, and he's the author of the new book, Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. You can hear him at Alexander Books in San Francisco right after the show today at 12:30. He'll also be at Book Passage in San Francisco Thursday, June 7th at 6 p.m. and at Copperfield Books in Petaluma on Friday, June 8th at 7 p.m. All of that information is at our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Matt in Sausalito. Hi, Matt.
Oh, hello.
Hi,
hello.
Welcome to your call.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I just want to ask David if, I don't know what exactly is in the book, and I may have missed part of the talk, but San Francisco was the origin and a starting point for several really important religious movements, especially the San Francisco Zen. There was the Beat Zen movement and the San Francisco Zen Center, and also the ubiquitous Hare Krishnas, who had a very big impact on the city. And I was wondering if any of that is mentioned in the book, the religious aspect of San Francisco.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Yeah, great point. And I totally agree with you that San Francisco also became a great center of spiritual innovation in those years and still is in many ways. The book does not focus, though, primarily on that, more on the political and cultural sort of liberation of the city and other great institutions we were talking about, like the Free Clinic and the Huckleberry House, which was a path-breaking shelter for runaway teens when it was against the law to actually be a runaway or to shelter a runaway. And a young minister, Ed Beggs, opened up that shelter. It's still alive. He stood up to the police to do that. He went to jail. So this was how the city was liberated, you know, corner by corner, neighborhood by neighborhood.
Let's go to Roberta in Richmond. Hi, Roberta.
Hi there. I wanted to talk about how Napa, outside of the Bay Area, but not all that far, especially as it's viewed today, was incredibly racist during that period of, let's say, 68, early 70s. They actually had, I worked at Napa State Hospital, none of the techs could live in Napa. They had to live in Vallejo. And there were actually gentleman agreement clauses in real estate contracts that you could not sell to a, it was phrased a little differently, but you couldn't sell to a person of color. There were no people. And it had a very narrow, rednecky kind of attitude. I wound up living up there, and it barely changed. And it was sort of like the portrait of Dorian Gray, where the outside was so beautiful, and what was underneath had a lot of, you're a stranger, you're an outsider, oh, we may take you in, but if you're a person of color, no way.
Roberta, let me, just because we're running out of time, let's get some comments from David. Thank you so much for calling.
Well, I think that's true, and I think people have this feeling when, as soon as they go across the bridge out of San Francisco, they're leaving Emerald City or Oz behind, that this is a city that's very unusual. And even you just have to go right across the bay, and you see a quite a different America even today. But let's not forget that San Francisco had its own race problems too. Not quite as open-minded as we would have liked to think. As we were talking about earlier, people had to fight for their civil rights in this town as well. And of course, the Fillmore, I go into this in great detail in my book, the great, vibrant heart of Black San Francisco was literally leveled by bulldozers by the redevelopment agency in this town, killed one of the most vital and beautiful centers of this town, the music, the restaurants, they called it Harlem of the West. And that happened in the 1950s and 60s. And we're still seeing, and in fact, I think People's Temple in some ways was some ways connected to that, because Jim Jones realized that there was a vacuum there, a power vacuum in the film.
And a lot of dispossessed people.
And a lot of dispossessed people who needed leadership, and he moved in and exploited that.
Let me try to get to one more call. Robert in Berkeley, welcome to your call.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I was a naive 20-something and came here from Akron, Ohio, and went to graduate school here from 64 to 70. And for me, it was a political awakening. I mean, you just went to some of those political rallies, and you could get the real story behind Vietnam that you never read in the papers. And it certainly turned my politics in a hurry. And just to add what the other person said about religion, or not really, the Eastern philosophies, you could still hear Alan Watts lecture.
Yeah.
And Ram Dass had come back from India and was telling us these bizarre stories, and a bunch of us went off to India, you know, traveling for about a year, and that was a very exciting time, and it all emerged because of being here in Berkeley.
Well, thank you so much for that, Robert.
And you saw that great, by the way, convergence of the spiritual and the political and the musical at the Human Bien, which was the event that my book kicks off the 60s with, in Golden Gate Park in January 1967. Allen Ginsberg, Timothy Leary, Alan Watts, Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Jerry Rubin, the Berkeley Radical. So, you know, San Francisco had a way of bringing this all together.
And we've only got 2 minutes left in the show, David. I just was wondering if you could reflect a little bit on sort of some of the meaning of this history for today, for Occupy especially, like you're thinking about the diggers and comparing them to Occupy. But the diggers got tired. You can't sustain free forever. So what are the lessons?
Very important, I think, to bring this up, because I want to write history that people can learn from. So look, I think what we learned from the 60s, like Paul Kantner says, if you build your own infrastructure, you build your own reality, that has staying power. Protests aren't enough. You know, taking to the streets aren't enough. That's important to liberate that energy, and it makes a big impact, as we saw Occupy do in the fall. But for the long run, you have to create your clinics. You have to create your, you know, businesses. You have to create your social service organizations, because that's what keeps people together as a movement. So we need to build infrastructure that lasts, like the Huckleberry House, like the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, like all the great media institutions that came out of this city, from Ramparts to Salon, my own Salon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my sort of words of advice built based on this. And also, be careful of not sort of going down the violent path, being provoked. You know, I talk a lot in this book about how movements, when they began to be effective, were infiltrated by police provocateurs and others who wanted to...
Operation Chaos?
Absolutely, for the CIA and the FBI. In some ways, I think Sin Q, Donald DeFries, who is the former convict who became head of the Symbionese Liberation Army...
That kidnapped Patty Hearst, yeah.
...was a creation of police agencies, because he'd been a police snitch and an informer in prison. So you have to watch out for that, too. Keep your eye on the light and not on the dark.
Very good. Your eye on the light. Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been speaking with David Talbot. He is the author of Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. You can hear him today, right after the show, at 12:30 at Alexander Books in San Francisco. He'll also be at Book Passage in San Francisco Thursday, June 7th at 6 p.m., and at Copperfield Books in Petaluma Friday, June 8th at 7 p.m., and we'll put a link to his web resources along with all of that information at our new website, yourcallradio.org. And that's also where you can post comments and continue this conversation if you have more memories of the 60s and 70s. Thank you all for joining us. Thanks for your calls and emails, and I apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What do we need to know about the upcoming California primary election? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the two statewide ballot measures to increase tax on cigarettes and to change term limits. Citizens will also vote in the 2012 presidential contest and local and statewide races. What's at stake? Join us live at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. How are you going to vote? It's Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produced the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.